This is the fifth day of this June 2017 seven-day session. And we'll pick up where we left off yesterday in the teachings of Japanese Zen master Muso Kokushi from the book Dream Conversations on Buddhism and Zen, translated by Thomas Cleary. To make critical studies and judgments of the differences in the utterances of enlightened adepts is mundane vanity and idle sophistry. This arises from ignorance of the real nature and purpose of Zen sayings. I think they usually mean koans. So he's just warning student or students about commenting on koans that they haven't worked on or really understood. This would be good advice for the growing number of Zen centers where they have what I've heard called koan circles. This is where, even though the teacher has never worked on koans with another teacher, they invite people to sit around in a circle and they take up a koan, quote unquote, and offer their different views as a kind of a literary exercise. And then later, anyone who participated in one of those circles can allude to when they worked on that koan. Another one. Zen teachers may speak of wondering about Zen koans, or they may speak of not wondering about them. Now, he's translating what other translators might render as questioning or raising the doubt sensation. He's making into wondering instead of questioning, which I think is really, I've come to feel, it's the best word for describing how we want to question a koan. It's really a state of open wonder. Socrates said, "Wisdom begins in wonder." And there's a purity to the word wonder. It conveys the complete openness and just the purity of it that I think is really gets to the point of what we're doing with a koan. So I'll keep his translation, even though it sounds a little funny in these sentences. Zen teachers may speak of wondering about Zen koans, or they may speak of not wondering about them. There is no fixed track for Zen teachers to follow. Sometimes Zen teachers tell students to look at koans questioningly. Sometimes they tell them not to doubt. In every case, a teacher is dealing directly with a student, not speaking in generalities. Zen teachings are not doctrines kept in mind by the teachers. They are produced spontaneously at the interface between teacher and student. One should not try to freeze momentary teachings into fixed theories. There's a saying from China, from the Chan tradition in China, to express the teaching the same way. If we were to express the teaching the same way every time, the weeds would grow 10 feet tall in front of the monastery. Weeds in Zen parlance, weeds mean delusions. So in other words, not to adhere slavishly to certain fixed forms of teaching, but to be able to accommodate the teaching, the Dharma, to whomever is before one. And then he says, if Zen teachers are enlightened, their teaching may effectively take any form. If they are not enlightened, whatever form their teaching may take will actually blind their students. It gets to the whole matter of skillful means. You can say that there are two aspects to offering help. One is to have the wisdom, but then that alone is not enough. There has to be the way to apply the wisdom, and that the phrase we usually use is skillful means. And those skillful means are not fixed. There's no book about how to skillfully apply the teaching to any situation or to any student. That's the real art of it. But it starts with wisdom, seeing into the essential nature of the reality. And then from that, there can come any number of ways of presenting one's understanding. He continues, sometimes Zen teachers give students koans to investigate. Sometimes they take koans away and have students abandon them. It is all a matter of method, not to be standardized. Next one. Direct indications of the fundamental do not contain their intention in their literal expression. Therefore, students with keen faculties understand the import outside the words. In other words, the spirit behind the words. In that case, how could there be any further discussion about the literal phrasing? Duller students who linger over words find that they cannot figure them out intellectually. As long as their aspiration for enlightenment is unbending, their minds congeal in wonder. Some may break through this wonderment in a few days. Others may take months, years, or even decades. This congealed wonder, this is the doubt mass, puts a halt to compulsive intellectualizing, enabling the student to break through to a trans-conceptual mode of consciousness. There's nothing trans-conceptual about that phrase. This is why ancient Zen masters said, there is great enlightenment where there has been great wonder. Well, most of you have heard that famous saying in Zen, where a master said, great doubt. Usually they say great doubt. Let's make it wonder. Great wonder, great enlightenment. Small wonder, small enlightenment. No wonder, no enlightenment. Still, if one feels that the questioning just isn't there, then, as I've said so many times, it's enough just to purely concentrate on the koan and not to try to force some unnatural questioning. People meditating on the fundamental carry out their ordinary tasks and activities in the midst of meditation, and carry out meditation in the midst of ordinary tasks and activities. There is no disparity between meditation and activity. So this is the true Zen. It's far beyond just sitting in a certain posture. It's something we want to try to carry on all the time. Everything we're doing. It's very difficult, but that is really a really complete Zen practice. He says it is for those as yet incapable of this, those weak in focusing their intent on the way, that special meditation periods were set up. The practice of meditating four times a day in Zen communities began in this manner during the 12th century. You have to wonder now about something about the translation, because we know that there were monastic communities sitting together morning and night before the 12th century. But what's interesting, leaving that aside, what's interesting is this the help of setting up blocks of sitting that are required. This is what we learn, of course, in training at the Zen Center, residential training, is when you have a schedule that you have to follow can be extremely helpful. And this meditating four times a day, well, that would roughly correspond to our Sesshin schedule. There's the early morning block, the later morning block, the afternoon block, and the evening block. In ancient times, Zen monks meditated 24 hours a day. Again, meditate probably means also in activity, keeping the mind aware and attentive and not lost in thought. In later times, however, there were those who became monks to avoid the trouble of making a living in the ordinary world. Their appetites distracted them from Buddhism, let's say their cravings. And when they participated in rituals, their attention was taken away from the fundamental. Since these and other things inhibited them from work on the fundamental, they would have wasted their lives had not some other expedient been devised. This expedient was the rule of four daily periods of sitting meditation. Most of you know what scholars have said was that in the Tang Dynasty, in the Sung Dynasty, China, many of the monks were not there in the monastery out of their spiritual aspiration, or at least not originally, and also, they say, also never in their life did they reach that point. They were there, they were placed there often by their parents who couldn't afford to raise them. And then the child grew up in the monastery and would just by, as a matter of course, become ordained, become a monk, and then may or may not feel motivated to really practice sincerely. It wasn't just adoptions that would land people in the Chan monasteries, but those who were avoiding paying taxes, I think I've read even those who had run afoul of the law could find themselves Chan monks. And so, just to create a structure and rein in this motley bunch of monks, they established these sittings, these group sittings. And he continues, people who really have their minds on the way, in contrast, do not forget work on the fundamental, no matter what they are doing. Yet if they still distinguish this work from ordinary activities, even as they do them together, they will naturally be concerned about being distracted by activities and forgetting the meditation work. This is because of viewing things as outside the mind. Let's just comment on this phrase that he's chosen, the translator has chosen, work on the fundamental. That's what we're doing in Sesshin, that's what we're doing in Zazen. We're working on, you could also say, the host and not the guest. The guest would be all of the changing phenomena that might file through the mind and body mind. And the fundamental, by contrast, is that which is beyond change, beyond changing conditions or circumstances. The perfect simile is the sky with clouds in it. The clouds come and go, and yes, they obscure the view of the moon of enlightenment. Clouds come and go, but behind the clouds, that clear, that featureless sky is what we could call the fundamental, that which is beyond coming and going. We could also call that the no mind, the movement of the clouds, the shifting and changing of the forms and colors of the clouds is the world of relativity, manyness, differentiation, change. So that's one side of the equation. The other is that which is beyond change, beyond features, beyond characteristics, beyond time or space. That's the realm of no mind. An ancient master said, "The mountains, the rivers, the whole earth, the entire array of phenomena are all oneself." And then Musso says, if you can absorb the essence of this message, there are no activities outside of meditation. You dress in meditation and eat in meditation. You walk, stand, sit, and lie down in meditation. You perceive and think in meditation. You experience joy, anger, sadness, and happiness in meditation. That is, we do these things with an undivided mind. Singly, wholly. As hard as Zazen, sitting Zen meditation is, it's even more difficult to keep the mind still and open and aware and alert in activity. That too is part of Sesshin, is to practice that, not to leave one's practice in the Zendo as we go out for breaks, for meals, or whatever, but to try to keep it continuous. Well, that means, just to spell it out for people who, while sitting, are doing a breath practice, then when they're out and doing things outside the Zendo, say, then it's just to be completely one with whatever they're doing. And that means noticing thoughts. When thoughts intrude, to drop them. Just get fully into the doing of it. At a Zen temple I trained in Japan, the teacher, Tangen Roshi, would occasionally, as he walked through the Zendo during Sesshin, he would say, "Only doing." He had this lovely lilt to his voice. He had very, very limited English, but I can still hear him saying, "Only doing. Only doing." Not doing and thinking, not a divided mind, just the pure eating, just eating, just walking. And then for those working on a koan, there is just the koan continues unbroken. The awareness of the koan is continuous in whatever we're doing. Next one is about relinquishment and renunciation. If it is granted that there is no distinction between meditation and ordinary activities, right, then it appears contradictory for Zen and other schools of the Buddhism to urge students to let go of things and be aloof from objects. In other words, one could argue, okay, why withdraw to a monastery if everything we do we can make into meditation? And then he takes this up. An ancient master said, "The teaching has no fixed form. Whatever you encounter is the source." And then Musso, "The methods of teaching used by the wise to guide students have no fixed form or appearance. Since it is a general principle of all universalistic Buddhist schools that there is no discrepancy between Buddhism and worldly phenomena, no genuine teachers could say there is a practice of Buddhism outside of events and activities." Well, of course, we make everything. That's the world we live in. We live in a world of phenomena, of activities, of this and that, of work and family. So this is speaking from the point of view of non-discrimination. That theoretically, yes, one could be living in the White House and doing meditation all the time. Why should there be any distinction? There's just the doing, just pure whatever. But, he says, nevertheless, because people who do not understand this entertain false ideas about things of the world, in other words, because we become ensnared by our work and people at work and family and all kinds of worldly concerns, because we get ensnared by them, Zen teachers tell them to relinquish things temporarily so as to enable them to get rid of their fixations. So expedient means, as a tactic, a strategy, that it can be helpful for periods of time to simplify one's life in order not to have as many temptations that pull the mind away from the fundamental. There used to be popular chain of Zen centers in Europe. I think it was sort of headquartered in Paris, where I was told by more than one person that at Sesshin's, at this Zen center in Paris, they had an open bar. What? And for sure, if they had been challenged, they would have said, "Well, what do you mean? Everything is the Dharma. Everything is one." Blah blah blah. But of course, we know, because we haven't drunk the Kool-Aid there, that there are places, there are things that contribute to stronger practice, and one of them would be not drinking alcohol during sesshin. Might be more fun, but... at the same place, I was told by people who had been there that the beginning of each kinhin, after they would stand up and bow, they'd turn to the person who would be in front of them in the kinhin line and massage their shoulders, which isn't so terrible. I mean, it has some point to it, but it's the kind of thing that could invite distractions, of course, and problems, especially mixed with alcohol. That's a slippery slope. But back to Muso Kokushi. He says, the father of the Buddha was a king. After his son attained Buddhahood and had begun to attract followers, the king had 500 members of his clan become monks and nuns. Hearing the Buddha tell his followers not to adorn their clothing or their dwelling places, one of these monks realized he could not follow the Dharma because, as a member of a royal clan, he was used to luxury. The Buddha had a senior disciple go to the royal palace and obtain all sorts of finery to decorate a place for this monk, and had the monk stay there for the night. Because his usual cravings for luxury had been fulfilled, the monk's rambling thoughts spontaneously stopped and clarity of mind emerged. In the last part of the night, he came to awakening. I think we should take this as a parable. That would be another source of monks in monasteries, is to be ordered by the Buddha, 500 of in the clan, to go there. And you also have to, just to be kind of critical here, you have to wonder about this spending one night in luxury. It would be quite remarkable if his usual cravings for luxury had been fulfilled in that one night. But let's take it as a story and get the point here. The senior disciple was amazed by all of this and asked the Buddha about it. The Buddha said, there are those whose attention to the Dharma is fostered by adorning their clothes and houses. For them, such adornment is an aid to enlightenment. Then again, there are those whose attention to the Dharma is diminished by fancy clothing and furnishings. These people should therefore beware of such things. Realization of the way and attainment of its fruits depend entirely on the mentality of the practitioner. With no necessary relationship to such things as clothing and dwelling places. This is an important point, especially in a sangha that is 99% householders, is to accept one's position at whatever, in any particular point in life, and also to recognize one's karma, one's karmic affinity. If giving things up, if relinquishing one's comforts or pleasures would if one is not ready to do that, then yes, you could say that it's better to practice with those comforts and pleasures if one isn't ready to give them up. We don't want to try to give things up before we're ready to give them up. It backfires. It doesn't have to. If one had stupendous willpower, one could give things up and stay with it. And one would be changed in doing that, in living in a more Spartan environment with fewer diversions and pleasures open to one. It's a fine line. We don't want to try to force ourselves to give things up before we're ready, but it also is not wise to just go on resigned to all of the pleasures and diversions that could go on distracting us from more serious practice. So something in between that. It's wise for us in whatever small ways we can to simplify our lives. Simplify them somehow. Eat less, read less, spend less time on the internet and on find ways to whittle away at some of the non-essentials in our life without trying to rebuild Rome in a day. See the wonderful practicality of Zen, the Buddhism, the common sense down to earth. That itself is wisdom, is to recognize who we are, what we need, and just accept it without resigning ourselves to it. Appreciate the difference between acceptance and resignation. Acceptance is something that is fluid. We can accept how we are now and what we need now, but recognizing that that can change. And so not just giving up. That's what I mean by resignation, resigning oneself. And then he just wraps this up by saying, so for certain people, finery should not be prohibited as a hindrance to the practice of the Dharma. But when people whose minds are not really on the way of enlightenment use such examples to claim that indulgence in luxury is no hindrance to enlightenment, they are deluded. And now there's a page here on landscaping. Remember that he became a master in landscaping. Since ancient times, there have been many people who have had special landscapes constructed for their enjoyment. Although the mood may be the same, there are differences of interest here. Some people do not particularly care much for landscaping themselves, but have it to adorn their houses to impress other people and receive their compliments. Some people are covetous in general and collect unusual rocks and trees as part of a hobby. Such people do not really appreciate the loveliness of landscape. They just like mundane objects. A famous Chinese poet made a small pond and planted bamboo beside it, finding much delight in it. He wrote, "Because the heart of bamboo is open, it is my companion. Because the nature of water is pure, it is my teacher." If people enjoy the landscape in the same spirit as that poet, they are not mere mundane sensualists. There are also those who are by nature plain and aloof, who do not care much for mundane things, but just nurture their minds writing poetry and reciting it in natural settings. These are the aesthetes. Yet even this, without the will for enlightenment, becomes a mundane routine. So I think in all of these cases, I think he outlined four different variations of motivation for having cultivating landscape. All four of them are worldly motivations. And then he says, some people turn to the mountains and rivers to rouse from slumber, clear their thoughts, and help them practice the way. Their interest is not the same as that of ordinary people enjoying the landscape. They are to be respected, but as long as they made a distinction between the landscape and the practice of the way, they cannot be called genuine wayfarers, practitioners, monks. So, but here too, it's so easy for us to now hearing these different less pure from the purest point of view, less pure motivations for having landscaping. It's so easy then to judge oneself or others because it's less than the highest, purest kind of motivation. But again, to accept ourselves and accept others as we are, as they are, and allow people to work in their own way, enjoy themselves in their own way. So easy to judge. If it helps, if you must come up with some way of talking to yourself about this, you can just say that their karma is not ripe yet to involve themselves in the landscape in the purest kind of way. Let it go at that. And then finally, people who believe that the mountains, rivers, earth, plants, trees, and stones are all the fundamental self may appear to appreciate the landscape through worldly feelings, but there are those who eventually make those worldly feelings into the will for enlightenment and make the changing appearances of the springs, rocks, plants, and trees through the four seasons into meditation work. That is how wayfarers appreciate the landscape. Wayfarers is such an odd word. It's how those who really are devoted to the way, let's put it that way. And then he says, so it is not necessarily bad to like landscape and not necessarily good. There is no plus or minus in the landscape itself. Gain and loss are in people's attitudes. Things are things because of mind. It's always the mind behind whatever we're doing that determines the purity of it or the value. It's to put it another way, it's not the things that we have or even the things that we do, but the degree of attachment we have to these. And that, of course, is so easy to rationalize. Well, I have a whole fleet of cars, expensive cars, but I'm not attached to them. No. And it's not just things, but activities. I enjoy, like some others in our sangha, like to play competitive tennis. And And I've had to examine myself about that, about, you know, the competition aspect of it. And without getting into any final determination, it's just clear that there's nothing wrong with competition if you don't get attached to the results. That's where things go haywire. That's the impurity of it. If one were to either win or lose, and later just hang on to that, keep dwelling in one's victory or one's defeat, that reveals that one is not really doing it for the sheer fun of it. Really, it's the same with running to Doksan. It's always been our custom here, somehow, our style, when the Doksan bell is rung for people to run. We make clear that there's no need to. You can go at any speed. But a lot of people like to run, and that can get competitive, especially if there's not much time left in which to get to Doksan. And the competition is fine as long as there isn't any kind of ill-mannered part of that running or then attachment to winning or losing. Always, it's not the activity or the thing itself, it's the mind behind it. One more here about tea and the arts. In China, tea is drunk for health. Just as an overdose of medicine causes trouble, tea should not be taken to excess. Remember, this is a Japanese master, but he's pointing to his predecessors in China. In ancient times, tea was valued as a stimulant to banish drowsiness and help people practice. The founder of Zen in Japan, that's Zen Master Eisai, also liked tea for its stimulating effect to help people practice the way. I've been told that green tea, that powdered green tea that you whip, has a tremendous amount of caffeine in it. And for some reason, the Zen monks took to it. Later on, however, the use of tea for health purposes or for practice gave way to frivolous overuse. This also created extra expense and led to neglect of the way. The liking for tea may itself be one and the same, therefore, but whether it is beneficial or harmful depends on the attitude of the individual. This principle also applies to the arts. The original purpose of the arts is to tune and refine the mind. Once they become objects of personal attachment, however, their refining action is lost and they turn into occasions for perversion and corruption. It is for this reason that Buddhist teachers sometimes say that there is no way to meditate outside of life's activities, and then sometimes they encourage people to set aside activities in order to meditate. In other words, there's no right or wrong. If you wonder whether you're contributing to your bondage to worldly things, then it's up to you to look into it. And that comes mainly through doing practice. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to the great endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates. exceeds beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain.